Well, I'm here alone, which is fine with me. Nice, cool room. What would you like to talk about? Give me a theme or something. There ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Yeah, let's talk about that. Of course, I hear you. Yes, so thought stream. Yes, what the hell? What is it about the thought stream that can feel so insistent? Demanding of attention. Whipping up scenarios. Scenes, sentiments. That can be so disquieting, alarming, trigger very strong emotional and somatic response. It also might be fun to look at whether it's there's a, can we say, a predisposition to panic or insecurity that triggers or fires up the thought stream. You know, in a chicken or egg way, or is it the thought stream unbidden that triggers or exaggerates whatever discomfort or disquietude or apprehension or insecurity that we may have or suffer from. The A habit of being a creature. Includes complement of several elements. Conscious contact. You know, being alive, conscious contact with phenomenon, consciousness, perceiving, sensation, emotion, time and space, imagination, the pursuit of comfort, familiarity, security, winning scenarios, wealth, abundance, nourishment. So it's a, you know, somewhat, in a manner of speaking, complex package deal. And it's difficult, maybe impossible, to discern where the triggering impulse arises. If we place too much emphasis on the thought stream, then we want to mitigate or medicate or control or avoid, transcend, you know, the apparent insistence and demand that the thought stream is making upon us. But there's more to it than just the movement of what is referred to as thought and the magical capacity to elucidate and imagine, right, time and space and implication. Yes, thank you. And since thought is referential, you could say it's a ground or a field of self-hypnosis. You know, who's doing the thinking? Who's listening to the thinking? Who's responding to the thinking? Who wants the thinking to stop? Without the curious presence of attention, the thought stream, well, it has no audience. So where the audience for our own thinking and the agreeability or disagreeability that may be conjured in us foments, right, more thinking, more feeling, more tonality, somatic and emotional tonality. And this movement of thought and the perception of thought, the listener of the thoughts, the responder to the thoughts, the so-called thinker of the thoughts, this is a field of hypnotic intoxication and appears ephemerally or etherically, right, in whatever one's mind or brain might be. So thought is, you know, on an even par with anything appearing in the sense field. Right? Things that are seen are appearing in the sense field, heard, tasted, touched, smelled, thought, are all appearing in a, let's just call it a neutral, a neutral field. Yes, I'm reading. attention can be greedy. And one of the elements that appear in attention, such as thought, attention is greedy for thinking, for implication, for definition, safety, accusation, orientation, plans and strategies, and what to do next with one's time. So most often this is a kind of a casual movement, not particularly painful, just casual. When circumstances in our lives go south or take us by surprise, then the, you know, movement of thinking and the greed that we might have for turning to thought for orientation or emotional wellness can certainly trip us up, because now it's not casual. You know, there's more invested in the movement and content of thought, because we're in a state of temporary or chronic alarm. And it's easy to project into an imaginary future with the refrain of, you know, what's going to happen to me? What's going to become of me? My circumstances, my safety, sentimentality, my ability to enjoy life. And similarly, thought, of course, can go to events in the past and find the perpetrators and those that have done us wrong or betrayed us, or circumstances where person or persons have acted selfishly, at our expense. So, of course, when we're in a temporary or chronic condition of alarm, the movement of thought, the exaggeration of thought, and the irritability, somatic and emotional irritability that can accompany it, can be intense, severe, unpleasant at a minimum. We could say that with the presence of, let's call it nourishment being ease of being, ease of attention, simplicity, non-grasping, that's the system, right? The somatic psychiatric system in ease. So the presence and volume and implication of thought is much more relaxed. It's not calling the shots. It's not demanding attention. If we are threatened or compromised in some way, psychologically, emotionally, what have you, then you could say we turn toward thought in a perhaps, you know, toxic reliance to provide succor, orientation, or safety to respond to the alarm condition. But thought can't provide the nourishment, the ease of being to assist us in returning to more sanguine homeostasis. Regardless of what might be happening circumstantially, there can be a relationship through the movement of attention with presence itself. Not so much what's present, because what's present is really quite impossible to discern. Thought only imagines it can discern and then opine upon or direct what it is that's present. But that's through conditioning and narrative and presumption and accusation. With a deepening simplicity, we can sense presence, but we're just not sure what it is that's present. So it's the availability which holds our attention, not the content. And even if what might be flooding in is unpleasant projection, still we can just feel how it feels to feel the way we feel without exaggerating or exacerbating the content or the implication. It doesn't mean it feels good. It could still be alarming or threatening or unpleasant. But we're not exaggerating the field by turning to thought for medical purposes as an emotional ameliorative. And as we are capable and interested in simply feeling what there is to be felt in the way that it's felt, is a cultivation of simplicity. We're not correcting anything, justifying anything, placing blame or insisting on causality or what we're going to do or not do about one thing or another. We're just being as simple as we can in the presence of challenging emotional or life circumstances. there's nothing cowardly about being afraid or angry, betrayed. There's nothing cowardly about feeling what there is to feel and suffer or enjoy whatever emotional or somatic outgassing may occur, writhing, crying, release. We just take it on the chin, don't we? And it hurts. It can really hurt. It can be very frightening and, you know, trigger all kinds of abandonment and enmeshment issues that may still be lingering in our psyche. Yes, and the various sphincters in the body, diaphragm, intestines, you know, throat, heart, sexual and organs of elimination, you know, various highly innervated, right, muscle groups. Yeah, we can really brace up a storm. I mean, you know, people can have very strong somatic bracing and, you know, to the point of nerve pain. You know, a panic attack is not just a bunch of bad ideas. It's full blown. Somehow we make room. We make room for how we feel. We don't have to feel differently. We don't have to explain or justify anything to ourselves or somebody else. We don't have to hold others responsible or pine for them to choose differently, or for circumstances to have occurred differently. There's understandably a strong orientation to the health and welfare of the physical body as myself. This orientation is involuntary. The constellation of sensation and conscious contact and emotion and mind, the myths perpetrated by society, by the religious thinkers and the scientific thinkers and the fascist thinkers and the economic thinkers, the spiritual thinkers, this is all trash. Really, the whole of the human Akashic record of thought structure and cosmologies is pure trash. sometimes it might be, you know, worthwhile to play chess with the angel of death. Just for fun. Just for sobriety's sake. You're in a face-to-face with your own imminent absolute demise. And what kind of baggage do you have? What are you planning on taking with you into oblivion? Resentment? Anger? Victimization? Money? Memories? You got nothing. You got nothing. So when we get, you know, embroiled in, well, our own restless imagination, in a sense, we're defying the angel of death, our chess opponent, thinking, oh yeah, I got a lot of luggage, I got a lot of storage, I got a lot of places to go and people to see and memories to harbor, and I'm just full of myself, full of myself. And we're vulnerable, of course, when we're full of ourselves and something in life goes south. Something casual or something major. Then this image we have of ourselves and our life, our security or insecurity. Gets pummeled. The goal, where there were one, of contemplative adventurism is to learn how to see through the constituents of identity, identification. The geometry and content of being self-infatuated and unaware or insensitive to the impersonal and rhythmic nature that life or reality might actually be. So we're taught how to value things, objects, which includes thought and emotion, superstition, religious, political ideation, belongings, including people and relationships and business deals and commitments. These are all objects, and we're taught how to strive for and procure, cultivate objects, as if those are the warp and woof of nourishment. security, success, the right, you know, to be existent. So as long as we rely upon objects, including the objectification of ourselves through body and mind and sentiment and memory and presumption, accusation, as long as we are inebriated, intoxicated by the presence and pursuit, cultivation and accumulation of objects, we're a sitting duck for anything going south, not living up to our demand, entitlement, or expectations. But that doesn't mean that we'll stop. Go through quite, you could say, quite a lifelong journey of suffering and disappointment and, you know, addiction and mediocrity, and eke out as much, you know, joy and relevance as we possibly can. What of it? We dwell as the product of our own imagination and suffer the indignity of the pursuit and accumulation of objects and remain profoundly malnourished, undernourished along the way. Coming to terms with the inertia of malnourishment and vulnerability is no easy task. You know, seekers who hang out with seekers, meditators who hang out with meditators, yogis who hang out with yogis, you can, you know, if you're lucky, you can, let's say, develop friendships where there's a shared interest and enthusiasm, right, for cultivating deep nourishment. But in the lion's share of the, you know, society, this is not the case. Contemplative inward turning. Is perhaps a somewhat rare quality. if we're at a certain stage, if we're at a certain stage in our own discovery trajectory, then, you know, we're interested in cultivating a different kind of relationship with living with presence, to discover what kind of nourishment is available to us as we wean ourselves from the nuisance of imagination, the nuisance of orientation. But so strong is the impulse to orient, to imagine that I'm about life and life's about me in the way that I'm in life and or life's about me. This, you know, this is a prevalent dream condition. But just here, or just now, if one can get a taste, if you will, of putting down the baggage of memory and orientation, association, superstition and strategy, sentimental attachments to people, places, or things, fondness for loathsome cosmologies, be they Buddhist or Hindu, Judeo-Christian or something else. Here we are. Here's this profound simplicity, not bound by anything that was previously thought about. You notice how thought feeds on previous thoughts. It foments continuity. Based on previous thoughts, presumptions, conclusions, that's how the orientation functions. If in the present moment, not that there is one, nor is it worth straining to find one, but here this is, more or less right about now. And if there's no insistence on orientation, no insistence on knowledge, security, then the atmosphere, the aromatics of being, well, you could say we, they, this has a chance to attend to itself. in an entirely different manner. Not through the lens of prior experience or anything thought prior to now. Not through the lens of correcting anything, making circumstances different or better or less painful. There's a solemnity, a dignity of not being the product of knowledge. There's a nourishment. That's present and palpable. When we're not interjecting the imagination of ourselves into present experience. Then the quarrel and the disagreement that we have with living or life or circumstances becomes naturally quiescent. I'm playing chess with the angel of death. The angel of death says, checkmate. Out of time. No baggage. I'm not bringing anything with me from the imagination of my former life into whatever the oblivion that awaits. That's freedom. Maybe. The projection of myself or the continuity of myself in space, time, circumstances, and events, presuming some kind of emotional, you know, well-being. That's just a form of hysteria. Even though that may be the more or less default manner in which many people live. Silence is not so much the absence of noise as it is the cessation of becoming. Free from motive, free from agenda. The restlessness, the urgency of becoming. Is quiescent. With it is the refrain or habit of self-concern. So the power of imagination that conjures individuated sense of self, preoccupation with the imagination of oneself, consternation and quarrel with life itself, that all becomes remarkably soft, non-defining. We don't have to fix anything. Even if we're winning the chess game and we've got the angel of death on the run, still we knock over our king. We resign the game. Take me. Where's the harm? Who harmed me? Who betrayed me? Who took advantage of my good and naive nature? No one. Nothing. It's only the pride that we all carry. The pride of self, preoccupation with the image of myself, the imagination of myself, and the way I appear to be occupying what I call life, that's what's injured. The myth is injured, and we get very excited about it. Heartbreak and rage can kill people. Why shouldn't it? Why should it be so superficial that it can't compromise your very life? Why shouldn't it be ferocious? Why shouldn't ignorance and imagination be ferocious? Lethal. The reflex to define ourselves and to cling to and promote individuated continuity, and the attention seeking that accompanies that, burns a lot of calories, places a lot of psychic demand on our attention, on our capacity to thrive. And most often we simply habituate to it. We know there might be a bunch of stuff missing from our lives. We might think it's affection, money, belongings, notoriety, celebrity, success, friends, a car that works, food. We find all kinds of indignation in our imagination and then suffer accordingly. I'm sitting in a first world Western nation, an air-conditioned environment on a hot and humid day. Food in my belly. Food in the fridge. Gas in the car. Nimble fingers. And still some degree of continency. What am I complaining about? What could I find that's not right with the world, not right with my world? It's impossible to even pretend to say anything pithy or useful, insightful, spiritual, really, about any fucking thing. It's impossible. It's absurd. This is theater. Mind has nothing to do with anything. It's a self-contained, circumloquacious bolus of self-reference. It's a closed system. But we think we can use mind and thought to give us the news, the report on our condition, to be effective in the world. I don't know what that is. If we could experiment with the abandonment of mind, the abandonment of knowledge, ideas, conclusions made, what might we find? How would presence feel? Unafflicted by association, by thought and projection. Here's your chance. It's always your chance. Here's your chance again. If we don't feed the capacity of referential accusation, we release ourselves from the impulse for distraction and orientation. Well, here this is. Maybe we come to terms with the profundity of whatever presence or reality might be without the pollutant, the demand, the distraction of myself or what it is that I hold to be true, what it is that I cherish. If our consciousness, our experience, if our relationship with it is not dignifying, is not ecstatic, is not nourishing, then we're living in distraction. We're living under the influence of becoming, which is the projection of psychological time. It's an avoidance and deferral relationship because we're not present. We're daydreaming. Maybe self-care has more to do with stillness and simplicity than it does with tasks and efficiency and doing and getting, repeat. Maybe buoyant disinterest in the texture of present experience is more nourishing, a better or deeper sign of self-care than to be embroiled in imagination. There's no poo. There's no anthropomorphization that need accompany the simplicity of present experience. Intimacy with presence annihilates the who. or the question of there even being a who, or a Horton, for that matter. In simplicity, there's no pressure, performance pressure, for anthropomorphization. Good night, Stephen. Nice to see you. If and as experience is not punctuated by the acquisitiveness and the grasping of thought, of association, of orientation, platitudes, it's felt very differently. There is an immersion. Suchness without avoidance. The presence of so-called oneself as the experiencer is the movement of avoidance. So the yoga then is to turn the tables on the reflex and the habit of avoidance. And whatever the fuck it means to just be here, do that. There's no negotiation with negotiation. We feel how it feels to feel how it feels to feel. Repeat. And that's all you can find, is this streaming nature of feeling tone as the narrative softens and the negotiation softens. It's just nourishment itself. It has no name. One is released from the habit or refrain to conceive. This simplicity is not far away, far afield. It's exactly what this is. One needn't travel through the mediumship of intermediaries, whether those are teachers, teachings, cosmologies, vows, trinkets, disciplines, merch tables, and more. this simplicity is oneself. Dignifying, solemn, empty, real. It's so good it doesn't need a name. It defies explanation anyway. So there you have it. Inquiry into Awakening delivers each and every time. No claims need be made. So remember, kids, this isn't about anything. Thanks for being here. Bye.